Good morning. So last time we finished up talking about our single instruction multiple data parallelism with some examples of one way of accessing those instructions when your compiler isn't clever enough to figure it out by itself, just with intrinsic functions, which hopefully you all managed to do on the lab yesterday, and is for the smooth homework that's due next week, the second part of it. Then we started talking about a different topic, the process abstraction. So this idea that when we run our programs on a shared system, or even shared with multiple programs that are run for one user, we have each program have the illusion that they have their sort of own CPU. And the way we achieved that was with time multiplexing, that we divide up the time running on the CPU between multiple programs, switching between the programs, and we needed some hardware support for that. And the mechanism we had to support that was this idea of exceptions, that the CPU would jump to the operating system, even though we didn't have an instruction saying jump to the operating system. We also talked about the idea of an address space. We know that in each program we have what looks like our own memory, that all our stacks are roughly the same location and our code is at roughly the same location, even when we're running multiple programs. And that can't actually be true in the physical memory unless the OS did something like copy the whole program's memory every time it switched. And it doesn't do that. So we have another piece of hardware support, which is what we're going to talk about more today, of address translation, where there's a mapping set up by the operating system that decides what addresses your program access actually correspond to. And using this, we can give each program the illusion that they have their own memory, that they can put whatever they want at address 10,000, and it doesn't matter if some other program wants to do something at address 10,000. It's okay, because under the hood, those are really going to correspond to different addresses, and that's handled by the hardware. So we talked about a bunch of detail about exceptions, and we mentioned that there were actually lots of reasons exceptions happen, not just to support time multiplexing. So one of these reasons was external events, like our timer interrupt, which was the way the operating system could arrange to run to stop our infinite loop from running forever, and also for things that the program does itself where the processor needs to ask the OS for help. Like if the program tries to do a privileged operation, we want the OS to decide what to do about that. The program wants to ask the OS to do something special. We have this system call mechanism, and these are explicit things the program does. Explicit or implicit things the program does that need the OS's help. We talked about how exceptions get executed by the processor. And we had this idea that we'd set up this exception table that would point to exception handlers. And by we, I mean the operating system would set that up. It would give the processor a pointer to it. And the processor would use that pointer to decide, how do I run the operating system? And we mentioned how this worked with our out-of-order execution, that one of the things the processor does as part of implementing this is it needs to figure out how to stop the program at a particular instruction that, you know, like accessed invalid memory, so when the operating system starts running, it has all the correct values of registers up to that point, not including any instructions we might have run out of order after it. And finally, we finish up by talking a bit about user and kernel mode. So this idea that there's some things we don't want normal programs to do. One example was changing this exception table, because if a program could do that, then it could hog all the CPU. And on something like our shared department machines, we wouldn't want that. We wouldn't want me to run a program, and then you can't use the department machine at all. So our mechanism for that is that some instructions are only going to work normally in kernel mode. And in user mode, they'll instead just trigger an exception, ask the OS what to do. and we'll enter kernel mode whenever we have an exception, and we'll typically leave kernel mode when we do this special return from exception operation. And with this mechanism, the operating system can choose what runs in kernel mode because it chooses what's in the exception table, and it chooses what the exception handlers do. And just, as long as it's sufficiently careful in those choices, it decides what runs in kernel mode because it made sure the exception handlers only do things it wants to be done. So before we move on, any questions about any of these topics from last time? Okay. So just finish up exceptions briefly. So we have this big list of types of exceptions with some categories of names. We said we called some exceptions asynchronous, that weren't triggered by the program, some synchronous. And I have these names I didn't talk about much for the particular kinds of exceptions. We had interrupts, which is the name I was using for externally triggered exceptions, most notably from I/O. We have aborts, which we won't talk about much, but like sometimes hardware breaks and the processor can detect that. The most common case is if you have memory and the processor can somehow know that the memory isn't holding the right value, this is how it informs the OS of that. You have traps, which are a name for our intentionally triggered exceptions, and you have faults, which are our exceptions which represent some error in the program or something unexpected happening in the program. So, and when we finished up, we were talking about this system call category last time, where we use that to access various OS services that require kernel mode. And so one last thing I'd like to note about system calls is we said that these system calls existed for these things we want the program to do that we can't do, like allocating memory. We need to change our address space. That's a privileged instruction. We can't do it. And we mentioned that we have this calling convention, and I showed you this example here of this is how we might use our system calls. That we have this special instruction that triggers it, and our operating system is written, like our programs for function calls are written, to look in specific registers just because someone made an arbitrary choice to use those registers. So there's going to be code in the OS which looks at RAX and RDI and decides what to do. So something I'd like to note is that you might occasionally have things you call in C referred to as a system call. And, well, if you're calling it from normal C code, it's probably not, because you can't actually write the syscall instruction in C. So often there are these wrapper functions, which are just little bits of assembly that all they do is set up some registers and call the syscall instruction. But sometimes you'll see things refer to those as system calls. They're just wrappers for system calls. They're how you access them from your C program. Okay. So before we finish up exceptions, we have all this terminologies I've used for exceptions. Like I said, interrupts, exceptions, traps, faults. And those were the terms our textbook used and the terms I tried to use to be consistent. But if you ever read documentation, like if you pull out Intel's manual or you pull out ARM's manual, you'll get different terms, lots of different terms. Like no one agrees on what different types of exceptions are called. So that's why I didn't spend lots of time talking about what are each of these terms. And it means that if you're actually figuring this stuff out in practice, you need to make sure you figure out what do they actually mean by interrupt. Because sometimes they mean any kind of exception. Sometimes they mean only things triggered by an I/O device. Sometimes they might mean something else. And similarly, the term kernel mode is something where you might see some other terms. So sometimes people call that supervisor mode or privileged mode or ring zero. It all basically means the same thing. Also, sometimes you'll have systems where they have user mode, kernel mode, and something else. They'll have multiple levels of privilege besides that. And that's where you get names like ring zero from. So you have to, when you're reading documentation, make sure you figure out what exactly is meant. Okay. So any questions about exceptions before we move on? Okay, so said at the beginning, our main topic for today is going to be about how this address translation we talked about earlier is important. And what we're going to have is we're going to have our program addresses go through this mapping that the operating system decides on and get mapped to the real addresses. And this is so we can share our memory with other programs and only access what we're supposed to access. And we're going to have a term for our program addresses. We're going to call them virtual addresses. And this includes every address the program accesses. So if there's an address in your program, it's a virtual address. You have no way, as the author of a normal user program, of accessing memory other than using this mapping. So all your addresses are these virtual addresses that aren't the quote unquote real addresses on the machine. And these get mapped to what are called physical addresses, which is going to be our real addresses in the underlying memory, what the memory thinks are the addresses. And something that we can do with this mapping that's a little non-intuitive is that the program addresses and the physical addresses could have different sizes. So we're going to have this mapping, and we need to store it somewhere. We need to have it in some format, so we're going to talk about where is this stored and what sort of format does it have. And I'm going to start with a very simple example where both my virtual and physical addresses are very, very small, just so we can think about it. And then we'll like expand up to the size that real processors use. So my very small virtual addresses are going to be 10 bits. So I have here my program with a 10-bit addresses that it uses, and we're going to divide this all these 10-bit addresses into four different ranges. And I'm going to call each of those little ranges of addresses pages. And in this case, I've decided when laying out this program that I'm going to store specific parts of the program in each of these regions. So I'm saying that I've just decided that this bottom fourth is going to be where I'm going to put the program's code. This next part is where I put the program's constant data, like global variables and its heap. And then this last part is where I put the program's stack, which is just an arbitrary decision I've made. And the division I've made here is that I have these pages, and I've divided up the memory evenly into these pages. And it happens that my pages are 2^8 bytes in this case. That's a choice I've made. And it's not a coincidence I've chosen a power of 2. A power of 2 is going to just make a lot of things we want to do with these pages much more convenient. One thing it's going to make more convenient is that we can figure out which number of page we're in from an address by looking at the top bits of the address. And that's just because I chose a power of 2, so when we divide by the size and round, we just take the upper bits. And we're going to have a name for the remainder that's left over, which tells us where in one of these pages am I. And that's going to be our page offset. So this page offset, since it starts at 0 and goes to all 1s, tells me where in this virtual page 0 or 1 am I, given that I have an address. Am I at the beginning or am I near the end? So once we've divided up memory in this way, we're going to, you know, our program memory, we need to say what's the mapping to our actual physical memory. And this is where we're going to take advantage of splitting it up into pages. We're not going to specify each particular byte goes to a particular place in physical memory. We're going to just specify that we're going to divide up our physical memory in the same sort of way into units of the same size. And we're just going to say one page, one set of 2^8 bytes maps to another set of 2^8 bytes. So I'm just going to draw some arrows in this case, and that's the mapping I'm going to use. And this is the sort of form of mapping that modern processors use, that we divide memory into these fixed size chunks, both our program addresses and the real memory, and we just have a assignment from the program's chunks to the physical chunks, these pages. And so I have my assignment, and I'm going to represent this in some way. The simplest representation, you know, that I can think of besides a picture is just a table. So I have a table where I have my virtual page number, which I've written in binary, just so it's easier to correspond it with the addresses, and my physical page number. And I just have a table saying which goes to which. And if we want to store this table, well, I know the table has an entry for every single virtual page, so I'm only going to store the physical page part of it. I just have four things to store, one for each virtual page, which is just the physical page number, or some way of representing it doesn't map to anything. And we call this mapping the page table. And this is how we're going to tell our processor what the mapping looks like. Yes? So when I say, what do I mean when I say it doesn't map to anything? So if you remember when we talked about address spaces more abstractly, we said part of the mappings could be to trigger error. And this would be like you have space between your stack and your heap where you know from past experience if you try to access that, you get like a seg fault. And that would be that region of memory. It would be represented in this way. So it's that if the program tries to access it, I don't know what to do. It's going to ask the OS, what do I mean to do? Yeah?
So I'm just wondering, how big are the page tables? Can it fit on cache?
So the question is, how big are the page tables? This is an important question that we will get to later. So in this case, clearly we have no problem storing this page table. It's, you know, around, you know, 15 bits-ish, but we're going to have problems later, and we'll talk about what the solutions for that are. So we have this mapping, and what our processor is going to do is we're going to store this, and we need some way of dealing with that those non-entries that represent unaccessible regions of memory where we need to ask the OS what to do. So I'm going to have this represented with an extra bit, which is my valid bit, so I can tell which entries do I not have a physical page number for. And then I'm going to have my physical page number, which is, in this case, 3 bits because of the size of my physical memory. And the processor, when it gets an address, it's going to take it, and it's going to divide it up into those two pieces. It's going to use the virtual page number to look up a row in the table. So it takes a row on the table, which we call a page table entry, and it takes that out, and it looks at, well, first the valid bit. If it's invalid, then it's going to trigger an exception, say, hey, operating system, the program did access something without a mapping. What do you want me to do about that? And assuming there's no exception, it's going to take the physical page number and put it together with the page offset to get an address to send to our cache, or either our data or instruction cache. So we have our virtual page number that goes in, we get our physical page number out, and we just copy the page offset, the rest of the address, from what the program provided without changing it. And then send that on to the cache. Okay, so questions here. So one thing we alluded to last time is that part of changing what program we're running, doing that sharing of the CPU, means that we have to change the page table, the mapping we had, in addition to changing all the registers and, you know, making the stack pointer be correct for the new program. And this required some privileged instructions. But an important thing we mentioned is that not only do we need to make sure that user programs can't change the actual page table themselves, we need to make sure they can't edit the code which is doing that. Because if they can do that, they can make it change it to a different thing, something we don't want. So we have this code in memory. And I just told you that when the processor is running, it uses this mapping for all program accesses. And usually, this includes things that the OS runs in kernel mode, which means we need to have a page table entry pointing to this code. But we don't want, because there's a page table entry, the program to be able to edit that code and change it to do something else. And so we're going to have a way to support that, where the code won't be modified by the user program, but it's still going to be in the page table, so we at least have the code to change to a different page table around before we change to another page table. And our solution for that is going to be what I alluded to last time, that parts of this mapping are going to be marked as working in kernel mode only. So we're going to have things which are always in this mapping, but the processor is going to trigger an exception, just like it was marked as none, if we try to access it not in kernel mode. And by doing this, we can make sure that the code which switches page tables, which is going to be run from an exception handler, and therefore in kernel mode, can't be changed by the user program, can't even be read by the user program. And to do that, we're going to add another field to our page table, just another extra bit, and we're going to have similar logic to what we had for the valid bit, that we're going to check our user mode bit along with this flag and trigger an exception if it looks like the user program is trying to access our page here, which is marked as kernel only, which is where we're presumably keeping the code which does things like change to a different page table. Questions about this? Okay. So let's start getting into expanding out from this example, where we have just these very small addresses, and into something more realistic sizes. So one thing I'd like to say is that coming from our 64-bit systems, it seems like this page table must be awfully, awfully big. And that's going to be something that's going to happen. But it's not quite as big as you would expect, because our notion of virtual address size is not what it seems to be. So far, it looks like the size of the address I have in my program, that's the size of my virtual address. But often processors do this trick where they don't use all of the bits of every pointer for the virtual address. And x86-64 is this way. So x86-64 uses 48 of those bits, and the other bits just need to have a particular value. In fact, the choice they've made is that it just needs to be a copy of the signed bit of the address. And when we talk about the size of a virtual address or a physical address, we're going to be talking about the size that is used in those page tables that's actually used for the mapping. So even though you might have a 64-bit register, if only 48 bits of it are used, we're going to say that we have 48-bit virtual addresses. And this is a common thing processors do, partly because it's really nice to have your registers be 64 bits and not 48, but you might not want your page tables to be big enough for 64 bits. And partly because it gives you room to expand in the future, that you can keep the same instruction set mostly, but have bigger virtual addresses if you need them later on. And sometimes we talk about the size of address spaces. And when we talk about the size of an address space, we mean the number of things, bytes, you can address, you can access, specify specifically. So if we have a 32-bit virtual address, we say we have a 2 to the 32 byte virtual address space. That's the number of unique bytes you can name with an address. And if we have a 20-bit physical address, we say we have a 2 to the 20 byte physical address space. This is just the number of things which have unique number. And a little caveat of this is that if I say I have this size of a physical address space, you might think that that means, well, I must have that much memory. But that's not what we mean when we say we have that size physical address space. If my machine has 3 gigs of memory, my physical address space is going to be bigger than that, but not all the physical addresses are going to do something useful. So we're just going to have a whole bunch of physical addresses, and the OS better not use the ones which don't actually correspond to memory, or else probably not great things will happen. Okay, so questions about this idea of address space? Okay. So let's go into our issue of how big page tables are. Let's start with a simple case. I have 32-bit virtual addresses, and I have 2 to the 12 byte pages, 4,096 bytes. And this is the actual configuration of 32-bit x86 systems. So first, how many virtual pages do I have? These are the things for which we need a page table entry. Someone, see how I can compute this? Start out by saying 32-bit virtual addresses mean I have 2 to the 32 byte address space, which is the number of bytes with a number. And we divide those up evenly among our pages. So how does this work? Someone? No, no one's brave enough. Okay, back there.
Can you just divide by 2 to the 12?
Yeah. So you say just divide by 2 to the 12, and we can do that because we know we take sets of 2 to the 12 of them, assign them to a page. So we get that there are 2 to the 20 virtual pages. So we've learned that there are 2 to the 20 virtual pages. So let's think about the page table for this. And let's say we have 30-bit physical addresses, and that our page table entries are pretty minimal. So they just have a physical page number that's going to just be this whatever we need for 30-bit physical addresses, a valid bit, and a kernel mode bit. So give you a minute. How big is this page table? And check your answer with your neighbor. Yes.
Is it like 32 bits for like each entry multiplied by like the 2 to the 20?
Okay, so I'm going to wait till figure out if people are done, but we'll get to that. Questions? So who needs, some people look like they're working, but I'm not sure. Who needs more time? Okay, so your proposal is that we have 2 to the 20 entries, and we know that because each virtual page, we need to say where it goes, and it's going to be times the entry size. And you said you thought the entries were 32 bits. So why did you think they were 32 bits?
Because the physical address is 30 bits, and then you get the 2 additional ones from the valid and kernel.
Yeah, so we have 1 bit for the valid and kernel. And you said the physical address is 30 bits. So there's a subtlety here, which is that I said on this slide that we store the physical page number, but our physical address, we have our physical page number and our page offset. We split it up into these two pieces, and it's only the physical page number we need to store. And we saw this earlier here, that we're storing the physical page number and not the rest of the physical address we're going to get. So the same thing holds true here. So we have our page offset, which is 12 bits, because we need to have 2 to the 12 things in the page. And since it's 30 bits in total, we know we have 30 minus 12, which is 18 bits left over in the physical page number. So this is only 18 bits. We don't need to store the page offset part. And the main reason we don't need to store it is that we know it's all zeros at the beginning of the page. So we don't have 32 bits, we only have 20. But if we do the math, we get that we have 2 to the 20 times the entry size, which is 2 to the 20 times 18, which turns out to be bits, which turns out to be pretty big. It's multiple megabytes. So that tells us that we're going to have a bit of a problem with storing this, that we're not going to be able to do the most straightforward thing of just have the processor have the page table there, because, well, we could do that, but we've learned from caches that probably that's not going to be fast, that if we're afraid to have a megabyte L1 cache, we should be really afraid to have a megabyte thing we need to access before we can even access the L1 cache. Yeah. Oh, it should be times 20. Sorry. You were right. So the question would be asked, why did I multiply by 18? Because I made an error. So it should be times 20 bits. Yes. Yeah.
Won't there be some aliasing if there's more virtual addresses than physical addresses?
So the question is, with the scheme I'm proposing where our physical addresses are smaller than our virtual addresses, it seems like that if we that some virtual addresses have to map to the same physical address. And that is true if it's the case that we use all our virtual addresses. That would be the case. So that's one thing which could happen. Another thing which might happen is maybe most of our virtual addresses are not valid. Most of the page table entries are going to be marked as none, in which case we don't have aliasing, but there's a lot of the virtual addresses which just don't do anything. But it's indeed the case that with page tables, we can have multiple addresses which map to the same physical address, and that's perfectly fine. Okay. So we're going to go over solving this problem of how do I store that giant page table. But first, here's an address. Let's split that up just concretely into our page number and page offset, given that I have 2 to the 12 byte pages. So anybody need more time? So how, someone want to tell me how I should do this? Yeah. So you say there's a 12-bit offset, and we know that because of here. So we know there's a 12-bit offset. Yeah, so you said use the trick that each hexadecimal digit is 4 bits, so this is 12 bits here, and therefore the rest must be the page number. Note that I didn't even need to know how many bits we actually used here, whether this was 30 or 32. And so we get that our page number is hex 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and our offset is hex 6, 7, 8. Yes? Why didn't why did I use the 12 here as the offset? So there's 2 to the 12 bytes in every page. And to identify which of those bytes I'm referring to, I need 12 bits. Just like if I had one byte, if I had 2 bytes in every page, I need 1 bit to tell which byte is it. Is it the first or the second? So for 4,096, I need enough bits to count from 0 to 4,095. And that's exactly what the page offset does. Okay, other questions? Okay, so now that we are hopefully kind of comfortable with what page tables look like and dividing up addresses that way, let's talk about storing them somewhere. And we can't actually store them efficiently on the processor because, well, you know, we don't have space to efficiently store a megabyte of stuff. So we're going to store them in memory. And to do that, we need to decide how we're going to represent our page table entries as some bytes in memory. And here, I've just arbitrarily chosen, and the processor designers will choose, some way of deciding what bits in memory are going to be what parts of a page table entry. So I've said that my page table entries are going to be 16-bit numbers. And those 16-bit numbers, the 15th bit is going to be the valid bit, the 14th bit is going to be the kernel bit, the physical page numbers, bits 4 through 13, and the other bits, while they're unused, wanted to use 16 bits so I don't have to like do funny rounding to get something from that's split across multiple bytes. And you know, if you were writing C code, you'd access this by like using bit shifting and so on as authors of something more, you know, in the processor. We just get these 16 bits and we can easily get the wires that hold our physical page number or a valid bit and use them once we get it from memory. So this is what we're going to store in memory. We're going to just store an array of these 2-byte page table entries. And if I have an array, I need to know where the array is in memory. So what the processor is going to keep, not in memory, is what we'll call a page table base register, which is going to be the beginning of that array. And this will be what the operating system actually sets. Rather than changing the whole page table in the processor, when it switches between different address spaces to change between different processes, it's going to change this page table base register to point to a different page table. And that's going to point to some area of memory with a bunch of just bytes like memory usually contains. And this is going to have to be a physical address because, well, it can't be a virtual address because then we need to look up in the page table and we need to look at this to figure out where the page table is, and that wouldn't work out very well. So it has to be a physical address that we're going to keep there. And we can look in memory around where this is and figure out, okay, for our first page table entry, this bit here is the valid bit. And that's the next bit is the kernel bit, and these bits here are the physical page number, and so on. And we can look at the next two bytes, and that's going to be the second page table entry, and we just have our whole page table stored here in memory. Notice that I don't store the virtual page numbers because that's my array index. So I know how to look up virtual page number, say, 2, because I know it's entry, this entry here, because we have entry for virtual page 0, 1, 2. That's how I know how to look at it. I don't need to store the number 2 in there. Yes? Why are there unused bits? So when we access memory, we need to supply a byte to access memory at, because that's how our memory works. So there's not a really convenient way for the processor to access, if we got rid of the unused bits, we'd have to access the second page table entry, we need to access these bits and these bits, like something like this, and there's not a convenient way of doing that. So typically, processors, rather than doing that sort of awkward access things across multiple bytes that are split up that way, they just round up to a power of 2 number of bytes and access memory as whole bytes, even though that wastes some space. Yes?
You mentioned earlier how in the virtual address, some things don't map to anything. In the physical address, why would that be?
So the question is, we have some entries in our page table which don't map to anything, which are marked as invalid. Why would we have those? So we saw one reason for that is that in our programs, we often decide we'll put the stack way up in memory and the heap way down, and there's space in between. That still has page table entries that we fill them in with empty space. And you can actually see another reason here. So here, this is the page table entry for virtual page 0. So what addresses have you seen in your C programs that start with 0? One you've probably used a bunch in C and C++. Null. So if we want null to not be a valid address, this is how we do that. So that would be another reason to do it. If you want special addresses like null, this is how you can set those up. Okay, so we have this table, and we just have this little slice of memory here. Note that the table ends. We know how the table is just a fixed size because our virtual addresses have a certain size, and therefore there's a certain number of possible virtual page numbers. We just have an entry for all the possible virtual page numbers. And after that, it's just more memory the OS can use for other things. First bit of all these 2-byte array elements is our valid bit. And we have our physical page number as some set of those bits. And the operating system, when it wants to run a program, it's going to set up this entire table and then set a pointer to it, and then it can start running the program. And what the processor is going to do to access this table is that we're going to get our virtual address, which is not going to be so unrealistically small. This is still smaller than usual, but we have this big virtual page number. And we're going to multiply it by the page table entry size because we want to get how many bytes into the array that is our page table is the page table entry for this virtual page number. And then we're going to add that to our page table base register address. And this is the byte address of the page table entry. And we just send that to our cache. And we get back a page table entry. And that page table entry has our valid bit, it has our kernel node bit, it has our physical page number. We're going to split up the pieces of that. And we're going to extract our physical page number. And hopefully, we'll get to use that. We're also going to extract other information, like the valid and kernel bit, so we can figure out, oh, this wasn't something the user was supposed to access, and cause a fault, an exception, so the OS can decide what to do in that type of case. Then, just like before, when we had our smaller page table, we're going to copy over the page offset into the physical address. Then once we've gotten the physical address, we're going to finally send that to the data or instruction cache and actually access the thing the program was trying to access. So questions about this procedure? And so there's a term you might hear for the part of the processor which does this lookup and checking of the valid bits and so on called the memory management unit. It's just a term you might see. So we have these memory management units in our processor. And something to note about having these here is that it looks like that one program memory access has become two cache accesses. That we access the cache once to look up the page table entry and again to actually do it. And if we think about our entire pipeline, it's actually a bit worse because we access the cache once for a fetch to get look up the instruction address in our page table, then we use that page table entry to actually look up the instruction. And we might do the same thing again in the memory stage if it's a load or a store. So we have four memory or cache accesses at least per instruction instead of two. And it turns out that this is challenging to make fast. And there's some extra stuff we're going to do. It involves more caches that we'll talk about later to make this fast. For now, we'll just pretend we're always accessing the cache every time, but there's going to be some fix where we'll avoid doing that, and that's why this will not be horribly slow. But right now, you know, if you just did this, this would be pretty slow. If you think of our L1 cache taking like 1 to 3 cycles to access, suddenly we've made everything much slower. So questions here? Okay, so let's talk about a 64-bit system and do an exercise we did earlier. So earlier we talked about how we split up addresses for our 32-bit system and like what the page table might look like for that. We got a size of 2 to the 20 times 20 bits, which turns out to be a few megabytes. So let's try this for a 64-bit system. So my desktop in my office has 39-bit physical addresses and 48-bit virtual addresses. Remember, I have 64-bit pointers, but only 48 of the bits are actually used in the page table lookup, in the page table translation process. And I have 4,096 byte pages. That's 2 to the 12 bytes. So first, how many page table entries are there? And second, once you figure that out, how large are the physical page numbers? Give you a minute. Thank you. Okay, someone have an answer for either part? Yeah. So 2 to the 36 for the first part, and how did you get that? So that's 48 bits minus 12. So you're, okay. And you're saying, so, and what you, you know, the logic you had there, presumably something like, we have our virtual address, or we have our page offset, which is 12 bits. Therefore, the virtual page number must be 36 bits. And each of those 2 to the 36 unique virtual page numbers has a page table entry, right? Anyone for the second part? Yeah. So I'm asking, how many page table entries are there, not how big are the page table entries? And for the second part, I'm asking just how large the physical page numbers are. I'm not yet asking how big the page table entries are. That's a good question we'll get to afterwards. It is, in fact, what we're trying to figure out eventually. So for the second part, someone want to tell me how big or large are the physical page numbers? Yeah.
Yeah,
so how did you get 27?
Because I used the same 12 byte for two to the 12 byte.
Mm-hmm. Or 39 minus 2 to the 12. Yeah, exactly. Because if we look at our physical address, we split it up into our page offset, which is 12 bits again. And then we have the top part of it, which for 39 bits is going to be the physical page number exactly, and that is 27 bits. Yes? So the number of page tables, we want to have a page table entry so far for every possible virtual page number. So it's dependent on the size of the virtual address and the page size, which we're told here is 4,096 bytes, or 2 to the 12 bytes. Bytes, 4,096 bytes, or 2 to the 12 bytes. So if we had bigger pages, we'd have less page table entries. Because we have more things in one page, so we need less information to store what all the pages map to. Okay, so as someone figured out, the reason I asked, and this is bits, I asked how large physical page numbers are because I wanted to figure out the size of page table entries. And it turns out on my desktop that it looks like, well, if we have 27 bits for physical page numbers plus a valid bit and a kernel load bit, we could probably fit the page table entries in like 32 bits, but it turns out my machine uses 8 bytes because they have a whole lot of extra stuff they want to store in page table entries. And they also want to leave room for future expansion. So it's actually 8 bytes. So if we think about, we have 2 to the 36 entries times 8, which is 2 to the 3rd bytes. So that's 2 to the 39 bytes, which is 512 gigabytes. And obviously, well, not obviously, but I am not lucky enough to have a desktop with 512 gigabytes of spare memory for every program I am running. So that's obviously not what's happening. So obviously, the page tables on my desktop are not stored in this way. So something else is going on. And the solution that we'll talk about probably in some future class is that it's not just a flat table, that we're going to store something other than an array. And the reason we kind of have to do that is because I can't store half of a terabyte for every process I'm running. So we have these two problems we'll get to later, which will be the major topics of future classes of, you know, how do we make this fast, which is going to be extra caches, and how do we deal with our page tables being pretty big, which is that we're going to store something other than a flat table. We're going to find a way to save space And the way we'll save space is by not storing redundant information in our page table in some way. Okay. So those are future topics. But first, let's review a little about how our translation works with our single level page tables. And we're going to do some exercises where we aren't considering page tables in memory. We're just doing something separate. And I have just a very small memory. So here is my page table, which I'm saying is stored separately from memory for now, just to keep things simple. And here is my contents of physical memory. So at 00 is the contents of memory at address 0, 11 is the contents at address 1, and so on. And I have 6-bit physical addresses, so I have hopefully 2 to the 6 different byte values on this slide. And I have 5-bit virtual addresses, which we know because, well, my page table has 4 entries, so I have 2-bit virtual page numbers, and I have 8-byte pages, that's 2 to the 3rd byte, so I have 3-bit page offsets, so 2 plus 3, 5-bit virtual addresses. And since I have 8-byte pages, if I look at my physical memory, it's divided up into these physical pages starting at the beginning. So physical page 0 are these 8 bytes. Physical page 1 is these. Physical page 2 is these, and so on. Some questions about setup I have here. Okay. So with that set up, let's do an exercise. Here are some virtual addresses. Translate each of them to the value we would get when we load them from our program. I'll give you a couple minutes and check the answers with your neighbor, see if you agree on what's supposed to happen. I would strongly recommend writing things down, because I sure can't do these exercises reliably without doing that, but maybe you don't want to do that. Okay, who needs more time? Okay, no longer. So who, anyone want to explain any one answer they think they have? Yeah. Okay, so this is 11000. Yeah.
And the first two bits are the virtual page number.
Okay, and this is the VPN because, and the last three bits are the page offset. Remember, this is 2 to the 3rd byte pages.
And then you use the page table to get the physical page number, which is 000.
So we got 000 here. So we get a physical address of 000000 because we just copy over the page offset.
And then that's just that's 00 in the very first entry.
Yeah, so that ends up being this 00 here. And that's what I have. So then on the next one, we have 00011. So our virtual page number is 00, which ends up being physical page 010. So we put that in place of the virtual page number. And we keep the page offset, the 011, the same. And that tells us where we're looking. If we translate this back to hexadecimal, this is 313, which is hopefully right here, which gives us the value of 4A is what we'll read from memory when we try to read there. And for our 0A, we have 0 and 1010, assuming I remember my hex correctly. So again, we have our 3-bit page offset. So our page number is 01, which gives us physical page number 111. So this translates to 111010 as our physical address. And if we look at that in hex, this is A and 3A. This part is a 3, which gives us over here this DC. So 0A translates to DC. How about the last one? So anyone want to go through the last one? Or questions about the existing ones? I've already got my work there. Yes? That one's not valid. And why? How did you determine that? Yeah, so the virtual page number here, we have 10011. The virtual page number is 10. We look up 10. And well, there's a physical page number of 3 zeros because we have to put some bits there, but that's not the important part. The important part is it's marked as not valid. And so when we access that, what our processor is going to do is it's going to trigger an exception. It's going to be a fault. It's not going to work. So questions about any of how I did this? Anything you might need to know to do this? Yes?
The last one was 3A.
The OX0A turned into, this is 0, it turned into, yeah, 3A, which is why we accessed, got DC for it. How did we get 3A? So the How did I know to access? After getting 3A? This is DC is at address 38, physical, 39, 3A. Yes.
How can we only extract the 5 bits from the virtual address? Like, what happens to the other 3?
So your question is, I wrote out 0x18, and you're saying that looks like an 8-bit number. Why is it 5? Well, this is, I'm writing out the numbers in hexadecimal. I can't write one hexadecimal digit because that's not enough, so I wrote 2. That doesn't mean all the bits are used. And this is like just what we have to do when we have addresses sizes which aren't multiples of 4. And yeah, it's a trap a lot of people fall in is they really want there to be 8 bits in the address. It doesn't mean there's 8 bits. I just didn't have another way of writing it in hexadecimal. And similarly, if I wrote 0x3 for this second address here, that doesn't mean it has only 4 bits. It still has going to have 5 bits. I just didn't write the leading zeros because I don't need to write leading zeros. Other questions? Okay. So this is sort of the manual translation procedure, and this is might be similar to the sort of thing we would have you do on, say, a memory homework. Now, so now that we've like our practice with our page table lookups, let's talk about other things we can do now that we have this address translation. So we think of address translation as primarily achieving this goal of having multiple processes running at once and not interfering with each other. But there's some other tricks we can do that real operating systems do, but we might need a little extra hardware support for them. So one of them is, let's say, two users are on a department machine writing copies of Emacs. You know, and they're doing different things in their copies of Emacs. But if we look at the memory layout of Emacs, we actually have some things in common. In particular, we have this coding constants, which should be exactly the same in the two copies of Emacs. And it sure would be nice if we only had one copy of this in memory, if we didn't have one copy for every single person logged into the server who's running Emacs. And this is actually a thing we can do. We can have two page tables, one for each program, and they can both point to the same physical page numbers for the coding constants part of the memory. And that's a thing real operating systems will do. So nice savings. Now, but there's a problem. It's a subtle problem. So one question is, what if Emacs is broken? It has like a bug, and sometimes it tries to modify its code. You know, it's not supposed to do that, but you know, maybe there's a bug, it's out of bounds array access, goes into its code, tries to change it. And this would be a problem now, because now, you know, if this copy of Emacs modifies its code and it's shared, then the other copy of Emacs might mess up, and we've messed up our illusion that each process had its own memory now. But it's really valuable to do sharing, so there's in fact hardware support to let us have that memory be shared, but preventing this problem of the program accidentally modifying that shared piece of memory and messing up another program. And the main solution for that is we're going to do something similar to our kernel mode only bit. We're going to add these extra permission bits to our page tables entries. So we're going to have a bit which just says, can you write? And if that's 0, we're just going to say, nope, we're just going to cause an exception and let the OS say, hey, your copy of Emacs was trying to write its code, it's clearly broken, rather than letting it mess up the other copy of Emacs. And this is just a few extra bits we can add. And this is why, when I talked about page table size, we're going to proliferate a whole bunch of extra things for one in the page table entries. You know, this is the sort of thing that's really convenient. So here I'm showing we have our kernel mode only bit. We have a can you write to that page. And what that means is when we try to use that page table entry, well, if it's a write, we'll check that bit. And if it's not set to one, we'll just trigger an exception instead of allowing the write to happen. And here I have an exec bit. And what that would mean is when we try to fetch an instruction, we'll check that bit. And if it's not set to one, we won't allow it to happen. Yes? Yes. So in this scheme, to prevent this, this area of memory that's code and constants would just be marked as writable equals zero. And this is handy not just for when we're running two copies of the same program, but another thing we can do is have, you know, one copy of our shared libraries. We can have our C standard library. We can not have multiple copies in memory even. We can just have one copy in memory that all the programs use and just point to the same physical pages to make that happen. Okay. And that's where I'm going to finish up today. So next time we'll continue talking about more things with virtual memory.